how I like. If a museum is a collection of objects, carefully preserved and open to the public, with the exhibits cared for and explained, and behind it is an enthusiast who feels he has a duty to pass on his knowledge and love for the items, then why have the contents always got to be dead? Why can't they also be living things? After all, every other museum I'd visited so far was devoted to inanimate objects. Surely we could do with one bit of real, living, breathing, smelling, active life. For yes, there was a bit of a pong. In turn, the Scotsman introduced 19 different breeds of sheep, as each took its place, and explained exactly where each breed was from, its strengths, weaknesses, and peculiarities. I tried to make notes as he spoke, though he did rather rattle along. I also took photos, which helped me later to identify the 19 breeds. So refreshing at a live show, or even in most dead museums, to be actively encouraged to take photos at any time. Museum curators can be a bit fussy and bossy when you want to take shots of their treasures. We were in an auditorium with seats for about 180, facing a proper stage as in a theatre. This was the first show of the afternoon, one of four a day that take place 5 days a week in the season, and there was quite a lot of space to move around and take photos should you want to, but most people were pretty transfixed by what was going on, sitting still in their seats, even the kids, still wondering how it was all done. Yet it's obviously not a circus, as the sheep don't do tricks. They are there as exhibits, for us to admire and study and learn about. The 19 breeds that day were as follows. First on the podium, sitting at the top in pride of place, was a Texel. I think a capital letter is called for, as each sheep was representing a whole breed. Roy the Scotsman seemed pretty biased in favour of the Texel, saying that though it is a relatively new breed to Britain, originating in Holland and introduced here only in 1972, it is now one of our most valuable and popular meat-producing sheep. It also holds the world record as the most expensive sheep sold through an auction market. It did look rather plump, self-satisfied, quite aristocratic, but then he was sitting at the top of the pile, as if on a throne of his own. I say he, imagining him as a king as opposed to a Miss World, but at this stage, Roy hadn't revealed the gender of any of our star exhibits. The Cheviot was next, a much rougher, tougher, smaller sheep, a native sheep bred on the Scottish borders over hundreds of years. The Blackface didn't have much of a black face, which, despite its name, was black only in patches, while the Suffolk had a definite black face and ears. The blue-faced Leicester was, yes, a bit blue-eyed round the eyes, while the Kerry Hill, which comes from Wales, had eyes more like those of a panda. The Leicester Long Wool did have very long, curly wool, while the Oxford Down looked large and stocky. I gave a small clap when the Herdwick appeared, as it is our own breed from Cumbria, where I was brought up and where I live half of each year, an incredibly hardy hill sheep that can survive all year round, on its own, up on the mountains. No one else clapped, so I felt a bit embarrassed, but it seemed to ease the audience, who began to be more receptive and animated. The Swaledale and the Wensleydale each got a few murmurs of appreciation, probably because they are breeds people have heard of. Or perhaps there were some Yorkshire folk in the audience. The Ryland is one of the oldest English breeds, dating back 8 centuries, originally bred by monks in Leinster, and, according to Roy, the Lord Chancellor, when he sits on the woolsack, sits on a sack filled with Ryland wool. The Shetland looked small and bony, ready for a fight. Roy told us its wool can come in 17 different colours and shades, and is ideal for Fair Isle sweaters and tweeds. The white-faced woodland sounded more like a flower, while the mule sounded like a term of abuse. Castle Milk Moorit was a new name to me, but is apparently Scottish, Moorit being the Gaelic for brown. Svartbless, written on its nameplate, seemed like a tongue-twister, so I looked forward to hearing how Roy pronounced it when it eventually bounced forward to take its rightful place. It's a Dutch sheep, and the name means black with a white blaze. The merino sheep got a good poke from Roy, demonstrating what lovely soft wool it has. The Hebridean, when it appeared, arrived with a bang, charging up the ramp to its place and proceeding to knock over a small metal container with a lot of noise and bustle, greatly amusing the children, as it looked as if it was being very naughty. It did look fierce with its three horns. It did originally have four, as nature intended, but had lost one in a fight with another sheep. "The Hebridean is not daft," said Roy. "He's decided to have a self-service lunch." By this time, I had caught on to the fact that before each sheep arrived at its proper post, Roy had taken the lid off a metal container to reveal some sort of food, which the sheep quickly scoffed. While Roy was talking, he also chained up each sheep to its position, which explained why none of them had run away. Another man appeared from behind the scenes after all 19 sheep were on stage, having presumably been the one shoving them on in the right order. He then proceeded to give out bits of real wool for us to hold and play with and rub, and keep if we wanted. Roy explained what lanolin is. "Feel the oil when you rub it," he said, "much better for you than any expensive moisturizer." He said wool full of lanolin is fire-resistant, can hold 20% of its own weight in water, and contains no static electricity, so it is safe to use and far better than synthetic fibres any time. He told us about sheep shearing, and how the world record was held by an Australian who had sheared 720 sheep by machine in 9 hours, a big achievement, considering that sheep can weigh up to 8 stone and can take some handling. Alas, today no one wants the wool. A British farmer has to spend £1 getting a sheep sheared, but gets only 60p for its wool. So sheep shearing today is for animal welfare, to keep them comfortable, not to make money from the wool. We then had a demonstration of sheepdogs at work, showing how they round up sheep, obey commands, though in this case they were not working with the sheep, which remained at their posts looking bored. Instead, onto the stage waddled 4 geese. I suppose sheep might run all over the auditorium and could cause a nasty shock and a few bruises if one of the bigger, heftier ones landed in your lap. The geese, on the whole, were pretty obedient, giving the odd squawk and flurry of feathers, but moving in the right direction when prodded along by a border collie. One of the geese did fall off the stage and looked very embarrassed, but bustled on again. Roy shouted out 4 different commands to the dog. "Come by" meant move the sheep clockwise, while "away to me" meant anti-clockwise, "walk on" meant go forward, and "lie down" meant stop. Roy explained that the dog, having been given his instructions, bossed the sheep by staring at them with his eyes. He had no need to bark. Then came a Hunterway sheepdog from New Zealand, which did its bossing by barking. In New Zealand and Australia, explained Roy, one dog often has to round up 2,000 sheep at a time. So to save barging through the whole flock, the Hunterway has developed a smart shortcut, running across the backs of the sheep. Which it proceeded to do, running up the ramp and over the top of all the sheep in the back row. It did it 3 times, to loud cheers and applause from the audience. 2 cows were then brought up, a dairy cow and a beef cow, so we could see the difference. But this was somehow an anticlimax, for they just stood there doing nothing, whereas the sheep and the sheepdogs had been highly animated, very entertaining and, of course, tremendously illuminating, as there had been a subtle message behind all of Roy's commentary, which was roughly, "Hurrah for farmers, hurrah for sheep." He then invited the audience up on stage to ask him any questions, to see and touch the sheep and take photographs, which everyone did, milling around the sheep, oohing and aahing at their size. I followed Roy into his office, for he happens to be the big boss of the Lakeland Sheep and Wool Centre, though he was only doing 1 day a week as the MC of the sheep show. Roy Campbell was born the youngest of 3 brothers in Loch Goilhead in Argyllshire, where his father, Douglas, like his father before him, ran a small hill farm with around 1,000 sheep. His mother, Jean, also helped on the farm. Roy went to the local primary school, but as there was no secondary school in his remote area, he had to travel away to a state secondary in Dunoon, which meant living in a hostel during the week. He hated school, didn't like any of the lessons, and the teachers didn't like him, so he says, so he stopped going at 15 instead of at 16, as he should have done, in order to help his dad on the farm. Although Loch Goilhead is remote, at the end of a narrow inlet off the Firth of Clyde, it did get some tourist trade in the season, when steamers landed on trips from Dunoon. One day, Roy's father was approached by the Forestry Commission to use one of his fields as a caravan site. His dad agreed, on condition that he ran it. Until then, he had shown no entrepreneurial or business instincts, but thought that if they were using his field, he should be involved. It was from that day onwards he realized that keeping caravans on fields made more money than keeping sheep on fields. Roy's dad made a success of the caravan park and moved on to acquire a hotel on the same site, gradually expanding into a leisure centre and shops, building up a holiday business in which all three of the sons worked. One of their schemes was to build a curling rink, which, of course, is a winter activity, so they were wondering how to use it in the summer. Roy was on holiday in New Zealand when the idea of creating a sheep show came to him. Well, it didn't just come to him. He took the format from a New Zealand sheep show he happened to visit. They opened a sheep show in Loch Goilhead in 1987, which did well, but they were short of space as they had so many other leisure attractions on the site. So we looked around to open another sheep show elsewhere, perhaps in a bigger tourist area. I looked at Pitlochry, at Edinburgh, and then I thought of the Lake District. That was the furthest south I was prepared to go, though I'm sure a sheep show would go well in the West Country or Wales, which are great sheep areas. I'm nothing against England or the English. I just wanted to stay close to Scotland and my roots. I found a good site in the middle of the Lake District at Thirlmere, on the road and beside the lake, and agreed a deal with a local farmer. We had to go through the usual planning board meetings, and in the end our scheme was thrown out. They didn't want a new building going up in such a location. I thought that was it, we'll stick to Scotland. But someone who was on that planning board came back to us and said that in West Cumbria, which had for some time been seen as a deprived area, they were looking for tourist attractions to draw people away from the honeypot areas, and also for an indoor attraction for people to visit in bad weather. We were encouraged to apply for planning permission, and were also promised grants. He says he can't now remember the exact figure, as it was a complicated deal involving the West Cumbria tourism people having space on the site, which is now gone, but it did help them to build the Sheep and Wool Centre. It was built on a new purpose-built site on the A66 just outside Cockermouth, at a total cost of £2.5 million. Apart from the auditorium for the sheep show, and a shop selling all manner of sheepy souvenirs and sheep-related objects, they created a 13-room hotel, hoping to attract business people visiting West Cumbria. In the first year, the sheep show attracted 50,000 people. Then it went up to 100,000, and in 2000 it was reaching 120,000 when calamity struck. Foot-and-mouth disease arrived in 2001, and at a stroke, millions of sheep and cattle were being slaughtered. The movement of animals was banned. Tourists disappeared. When you show dead or inanimate exhibits in a conventional sort of museum, you might face many problems. Rival attractions, fashion trends changing, tourists going elsewhere, ring roads taking away passing traffic, someone opening up a better museum showing the same sort of stuff. But you don't have to cope with disease and pestilence that starts killing off every one of your objects. For a whole year, they had no sheep to show. When they reopened, they were forced to abandon one of the highlights of the show, which had delighted visitors in the early years, an exhibition of sheep shearing. On stage, live sheep were sheared by a real shearer, so you saw and smelled how it was done, and could touch and feel the wool straight off the sheep's back. To do this, they used around 800 different sheep from local farms, as, of course, the same sheep gets sheared only once a year. So every day they would shear 4 sheep, one at each show, then return them to the farmer, having done his shearing for nothing. post, foot and mouth, a new rule came in that restricted the movement of all sheep and cattle. They must remain in the same place for at least 6 days before being moved for any reason. One of the causes of foot and mouth spreading in 2001 had been the wide-scale and endless movement of animals across the country, with no records or restrictions being enforced. The government, in its wisdom, did not, of course, reckon on or worry about the possible effect on something like the sheep show, but it meant they stopped shearing. Unless they kept their own flock of around 800 sheep in their own fields, they could not shear 4 new sheep every day. So the sheep shearing had to go. One small side effect has been that the pong in the auditorium is now a lot less. When sheep were brought in straight from the fields, they were often wet and muddy, and naturally did a bit of excreting in the excitement and panic of being sheared. Audiences did often remark on the pungent aroma, which they rarely did once the sheep shearing ceased. To compensate for the lack of sheep shearing, Roy introduced the 2 cows. Normally, the dairy cow was milked on stage, which all the children love, but I had been at the 2 o'clock show, which, alas, is not a milking time. The point of milking the cow was to show children where milk comes from. Many children really do think that milk comes from a supermarket, along with lemonade and pop, that that's where it originates. They don't realise milk comes from cows. Same with sheep. Everyone knows about sheep, what one looks like, but even adults assume, without thinking about it, that there's probably only one type of sheep. They're not aware that in the UK we have 80 different breeds of sheep, and in the world as a whole, there are 500 different breeds. The Miss World stars, the different breeds on show each day, are kept on the premises in a field behind the centre. At any one time, he has 60 different sheep from 24 different breeds, 19 of which are called on to perform each day. All of them are rams, which means they can all be kept in the same field. Any ewes would, of course, lead to problems, and all the rams are infertile. That is, they have failed on their previous farms to mate successfully with a ewe. They're about to be sold off cheaply when I buy them, and are heading straight to the butcher's, so I give them another 4 years of life, and 4 meals a day in excellent conditions. They are all happy sheep. The food in their little metal buckets consists of just a handful of protein nuts, which is mainly dried grass, so they're not exactly living on the hog of the land. Roughly, they perform for up to 2 months each. Then they get shorn and can't appear for a while, as the whole point of the sheep show is to show the different sheep with their different types of wool. Naked, newly shorn sheep are pretty creepy. One would not like to stare at them without their normal clothes on. New ones get trained over the winter when the show is not on, taught what they have to do on stage, so none of them is a total novice when they appear for the first time in front of a live audience. I later went behind the scenes, where a local farmhand called Eddie has the job of lining up the 19 sheep before each show, herding them into 2 narrow corridors on either side of the stage, in the right order, then letting them out one by one. Above his head, he has the order written down, as it can change and lead to confusion on stage. I asked Eddie if they were easy to control, or could some get troublesome.
"Only the Scotch ones, but then the Scotch always cause the problems." "Watch it," said Roy, smiling.
Roy was doing only 1 day a week presenting, mainly to keep his hand in to see what's happening. Before Foot and Mouth, they did 4 shows a day, 7 days a week, but since then they have cut down to 5 days a week. They don't do Friday or Saturday, having observed that local attractions like the Cockermouth Show and the Farmers' Markets tend to be on a Saturday. Saturday also tends to be changeover day in the hotels and bed and breakfasts. On the other 4 days, there are 2 different presenters, both women. The Sheep and Wool Centre and its hotel have proved to be a great success so far, despite all the foot-and-mouth problems, and the family firm back in Scotland has gone from strength to strength. It is still privately owned and run by Roy and his 2 brothers, his parents having retired. Altogether, they employ 230 staff and have 7 holiday parks, 2 hotels, several shops, a leisure centre and 3 farms, plus the Shepherd's Hotel / Lakeland Sheep and Wool Centre at Cockermouth, still their only business on English soil. The sheep centre itself, including the hotel, employs 24 people. Last year, the group's turnover was 14 million. Not bad for simple farming folk who came into the leisure industry by accident rather than intent. Most farmers all over the world have for generations grown up with the feeling that tourists are their enemy, that they get in the way, are hostile, cause problems. A lot still do feel that, but I think in the last 10 years their views have begun to change, which is a short period of time in the history of farming. Farmers must be willing to change, to diversify. Luckily, the general public like farmers and farming. Look at the growth of farmers' markets and the fact that you now see even the biggest supermarkets promoting local produce. Farmers have made the countryside the way it looks, and they are the ones who are protecting it. They are the custodians of the countryside. If you got rid of cattle, fields would be full of weeds. Fields can't look after themselves. If you got rid of sheep, the fells would be overrun with bracken and rough heather and scrub. We owe a lot to sheep. Aren't sheep pretty dopey, stupid, sheep-like animals? No more than humans. Humans act like sheep as well. They follow a crowd. A fellow goes into a pub and finds it's empty, so he goes to look for one that's busy. Sheep are repetitive, like people. They like doing things at the exact same time each day. All animals get to know the exact time they'll be fed. Dogs know it, and dairy cows know it. They'll stand up and go to the gate when they know it's time to go and get milked. The sheep here now know what time each day they will be going on stage, and that they will get something to eat. Like humans, there's always some trying to be at the top of the pecking order. A sheep's biggest enemy is another sheep trying to take its grass, its space. You might think they are sheep-like, herding together, but in fact if you watch sheep in a field, they each like their own space. The mountain and fell sheep are smaller and thinner, but they always have a spring in their step, much more energy, which they have to have out in the wilds in all weathers. The lowland sheep are bigger, fatter, more docile. A wee Shetland or Hebridean or Herdwick is usually looking for a fight. It's the wee man syndrome, always trying to prove himself. Roy, despite all his business affairs, still keeps 70 Texel sheep himself, which he breeds and shows all over the country. And of course, he does one day a week as the sheep show presenter. My father always told me that you can't farm from a desk. You have to be out there, seeing what happens on the ground. You have all this modern technology, but you still need to go out and see that the job is being done right. That applies to all industries. He usually does 2 days a week in Scotland, back in Argyll, but lives in Cockermouth with his Scottish wife and 3 children, all of whom now speak with English accents, or at least West Cumbrian, which is not quite the same thing. They love their local schools, both primary and the local comprehensive, which Roy himself never did. Will one of them take over the sheep centre in due course, or will others in the family firm run it? Ah, there could be a problem there, namely blue tongue, something I had only vaguely heard about and thought had gone away. Blue tongue could just wipe out all our sheep. They would just die once they got the disease, not have to be killed as with foot and mouth. The disease is in Europe at present and might strike at any moment. One of our French visitors could bring the virus in on the wheels of their car. You just don't know. In Scotland, vaccinating against it is compulsory, but in England, it's only voluntary at the moment. We got completely caught by foot and mouth. We hadn't made any plans, even though we'd had a previous outbreak in 1967. But 2001 was devastating. The sheep centre still hasn't recovered, and all the after-effects and restrictions are still upsetting us. Visitor numbers are not yet up to what they were before foot and mouth. However, because we got caught last time and had to close the show for that whole year, I'm making plans in case blue tongue ever does strike. I'm applying for planning permission for another 15 bedrooms. The hotel side has been doing very well these last few years, more profitable than the sheep show. You win some, you lose some, that's business. I think we're getting more hotel guests because a lot of firms are currently trading down, wanting clean modern rooms, but also value for money. So,
If the worst comes to the worst, we could be forced to turn the sheep show into hotel bedrooms. I don't want to, but you have to plan ahead and be ready. We want to keep it going. It's not a gimmick. People have suggested we have voting, with the audience holding up numbers as in a Miss World contest, which would get us a lot of publicity, but we wouldn't do that. It's not a circus, it's a serious show. We're here to tell the truth about sheep and about farming, to help preserve interest in all the different breeds, as the general public is still pretty ignorant. I had certainly learned a lot, and understood a lot, and it didn't seem like a gimmick to me. Nor was it a circus or even a zoo. Because it concentrated on just one species, the sheep, I felt it did fit into my definition of unusual museums. It was being run as a commercial concern, but why shouldn't museums do that? They have to make money, attract the public or sponsors, as the National Football Museum had found, in order to survive. It seemed to have been doing well, despite unforeseen disasters like foot and mouth, and I wished it good luck for the future. So far, over 1 million people have been to see Roy's sheep shows. The Lakeland Sheep and Wool Centre in Cockermouth is the only one of its type in the whole of the UK, as their Scottish show has long since closed. It is probably also the only one in Europe, but they are still going in New Zealand. The family who ran the New Zealand one I first went to see came to visit us not long ago. I was a bit worried they would be upset I had modelled my show on theirs, though we have different sheep and a different script. But they approved of it. They have opened a sheep centre in Japan as well, but I think that's their only branch so far. They said as long as we stayed 12,000 miles away, they wouldn't sue. Lakeland Sheep and Wool Centre, Egremont Road, Cockermouth, Cumbria, CA 13 OQX. Telephone 01900 822 673. www.sheep-woolcentre.co.uk. The Sheep Show has now closed. See conclusion. Chapter 12. The Clan Armstrong Museum, Langholm. If you can have a museum devoted to one type of animal, can you have a museum that is devoted to just one name? In this case, a family name, the surname that people drag around with them. In one sense, a name is an abstract concept, a word written on a document such as a birth certificate, rather than an object that you can see and touch, keep and collect, which is how we normally fill museums. So, can a family name be turned into a museum? What would there be to show? Well, as we know, museums in the UK and across the world come in all shapes and sizes, covering many forms of content. Though for the purpose of my journey, each museum had to be devoted to one subject and, ideally, still have a founder or leading creator around. When I heard about a little museum that was all about one particular family, I was off, well intrigued. Over the Scottish border and up the A7, a route I hadn't taken for about 40 years. When I go to Edinburgh by road these days, I always go up the motorway as far as possible towards Glasgow, before turning right at Abington, as opposed to ye olden days when I took the A7 all the way, winding slowly through Langholm, Hoyk, Selkirk and Galashiels, ancient and gritty, proud and peculiar border towns, which look quite near each other on the map, but take forever to reach as you don't realise how big the borders are. Which was, of course, one of the attractions in the past, when you might have needed somewhere to hide. Past Longtown and over the Scottish border, the road suddenly widened out, went all modern and smooth with lush landscaped verges. And yet it was totally empty. How had they got the money? In the West Indies or Africa, you always suspect that an unusually brilliant and pointless piece of road in an empty landscape indicates that the local MP is also the Prime Minister, keeping his constituents quiet and himself in office. In the UK, it's usually the work of some sharp bureaucrat or department
that has had the time and energy to understand all the forms and figure out how to apply for grants from Europe, the lottery, or some complicated government scheme. Whatever the reason, the result was wonderful. I was able to glide along an empty, excellent road for about 20 miles, admiring the scenery. I quite forgot how I hate driving. I arrived early in Langholm. The museum is open only in the afternoons, but not Mondays except bank holidays or Thursdays. So I parked and wandered round. For a small, isolated country town of only 2,300 population, it clearly has a self-image above its size, with a very handsome high street, an impressive town hall, a fine bridge over a wide river, a good public library, and its own hospital, though when I got near it, I saw it said, "Welcome to Thomas Hope Hospital, no accident and emergency." It even has its own newspaper, the Eskdale and Liddesdale Advertiser, founded in May 1848, so it says on the masthead, and known locally as the Squeak. Langholm itself is known in Scotland as the Muckle Toon, which I've always taken to mean a town of many parts, as in many a Michaelmax a Muckle, a phrase I learned as a child growing up in Scotland. We finally settled for good in Carlisle when I was 11, and I soon lost my Scottish accent, alas, though we always took the Sunday Post and listened to the Scottish Home Service, Scottish Children's Hour with Auntie Kathleen and Tammy Troot and Doon at the Mains. In Langholm, apparently, the word muckle means big. For a small town, it has been quite muckle, in that it has provided two Scottish stars. Hugh McDermid, the poet, real name Christopher Murray Grieve, was born in Langholm in 1892. His father was a postman, and his mother was caretaker of the local public library, and they lived in a little house under the library. Thomas Telford started life as an apprentice stonemason in Langholm and went on to become a true Brit star, building roads, bridges, harbours and monuments all over the United Kingdom. I went into a cafe to read The Squeak, all about the common riding coming up. Too complicated to explain, but all the border towns have this ancient annual celebration when their boundaries are marked out. Horses are ridden, handsome young men get called cornet, and parades take place. Around me, I could hear some broad local accents. Interesting how they seem immediately to get broad once you are just yards across the border, as if out of defiance, whereas by the time you get to Edinburgh, they seem to talk like any member of a Labour cabinet. In the tourist office, where I picked up some leaflets, the woman volunteer was clearly English, from over the border in Cumbria. These days, they do seem to live happily together. I then drove to the end of the town, left, over a bridge, and there was perhaps the prettiest museum building I had seen so far, a twee little wooden log cabin shaped like a church, which it formerly was, but looking more like a little house on the prairie. This is the Clan Armstrong Museum, dedicated to all the people in the world called Armstrong. Would they have stuffed Armstrongs? Armstrongs hanging around, looking, strong-armed and manly? Would they have dead Armstrongs? There were some hints in the garden, where there are plaques to deceased clan members. Armstrongs cannot be buried here, but people do come from across the Atlantic to scatter Armstrong ashes on the roses. In the porch, I noticed an old bike hanging up on the wall. Inside, I asked Fiona Armstrong, who was helping out in the museum that day, getting ready for an event in the evening, what the significance of that was. "There's not another museum in the town, so we do tend to get a lot of local things donated to us. I think this bike did belong to an Armstrong. If it did once have an Armstrong bottom in the saddle, that does make it rather precious to us." The Clan Armstrong Trust, which runs the museum and is a registered charity, was set up in 1978 as an educational body to encourage research into the Armstrongs and to record and care for documents and sites associated with the family over the centuries. Inside, the museum does have a more academic feel than the bike might suggest, with historic documents and artifacts laid out and lots of storyboards explaining the history of the Armstrongs. "We hold the world's largest collection of Armstrong records," said Fiona proudly. I wouldn't have imagined there was a lot of competition for this accolade, not having come across an Armstrong museum before. But Fiona said there were Armstrongs everywhere, hundreds and thousands of them, all over the known world. Some of them very famous and eminent, and many were very interested in collecting and knowing their heritage and their family history, all of which began here in the Scottish borders, back in, well, the Dark Ages. No one is quite sure. Armstrong family records can be traced back to around 1223. They are one of those border families whose names you still see all over the English-Scottish border today, along with Elliot, Scott, Johnston, Graham, Maxwell, Hume, Carr, Bell, Douglas, Moffat, Turnbull, Nixon, Jardine, Beattie, and several others. 500 years ago, they were known as reavers, families who were essentially cattle thieves and sheep stealers, lawless men who held sway for several centuries, crossing the border and stealing from each other. They were just as likely to fight any other Scottish clan or English authority which tried to control them. It was said that on hunting raids, the Armstrongs would carry two flags in their saddlebags, an English and a Scottish one, not knowing which side might capture them. The Scottish kings, based further north, quite liked having this unruly, wicked, nasty, quarrelsome mob occupying the borderlands to their south, known as the Debatable Lands, as no one could quite decide who they belonged to. They acted as a buffer state, keeping the English army at bay, or at least making it harder for them to march swiftly towards Edinburgh. The Armstrongs were the fiercest of these border clans, able to muster up to 3,000 riders, about twice as many as any other family. Able men, so it was said, but somewhat unruly and very ill to tame. Evil-disposed people, thieves, inclined to wildness and disorder. They have a persuasion that all property is common by the law of nature, and is therefore liable to be appropriated by them in their necessity. They got their name, supposedly, for having strong arms, and there were Armstrong strongholds with castles, peel towers and fortified farmhouses right along both sides of the present-day border, in Cumberland and across Northumberland to Newcastle, as well as on the Scottish side. In 1603, King James VI of Scotland became James I of England and moved south to London. He suddenly wasn't so keen to have these powerful, unruly, thieving clans dominating the centre of his new kingdom, viewing them now in the way we might see gangsters or the mafia, rather than as romantic Robin Hoods. He set about rounding up the reavers. Families like the Scots and Johnstons chose to work with the crown, laying down their swords and being rewarded with lands and titles. The Armstrongs opted to carry on as before, hoping to cling on to their feudal power, fighting to the death, which is mainly what happened. They were either hunted down and killed, or shipped to Northern Ireland. To survive the persecutions, some of the other expelled clans, such as the Grahams, are said to have changed their names on board ship, turning themselves into Maharghs, which is Graham backwards, but the Armstrongs proudly kept their clan name when they got to Ireland, and it is still widespread there today. The last Armstrong chief was hanged in 1611. His son and heir fled for his life and was never seen again. Their brutal extermination became the subject of myths, ballads and legends, kept alive and often embroidered by writers and poets like Sir Walter Scott and, in more recent times, George MacDonald Fraser, in his fine book, The Steel Bonnets. I must admit, my eyes have gone glazed over the years when I have come across stories about Lang Sandy, a 16th-century Armstrong who was hanged along with his 11 sons, or Johnny Armstrong, who was similarly dispatched, or Kinmont Willie Armstrong, who tricked the Queen of England and managed to escape imprisonment in Carlisle Castle. I'm sure all these people and stories are basically true, but they seem to have become adorned with such confusing mad facts and daft legends over the centuries that most now seem fairly nonsensical. It was to get at the truth of the Armstrongs and sort out fact from fiction that the Clan Armstrong Trust was created and their little museum opened. It took over a former Church of Scotland church, which it rents for a peppercorn pound a year from the estate of the Duke of Buccleuch, who seems to own everything in the Borders. But the Trust has to maintain it, and recently had to find £4,000 for rewiring. One day, they would like to install a lavatory. They attract between 800 and 1,000 visitors a year, most of whom are Armstrongs or have Armstrong connections, and who come from all over the world, judging by the visitors' book. And they all love it, finding it truly awesome, according to their comments. Visitors don't bring in much money, but the Trust make quite a steady income online, selling Armstrong souvenirs like pens, keyrings, tea towels and books. The curator is Anne Dalgleish, a local ex-primary school teacher in her 50s. 4 years ago, recently widowed, she heard about the job when she was in the Langholm Co-op. A friend asked her what she was doing, and she said she was thinking of looking for part-time work. "I didn't know anything about the Armstrongs, but I went along, got interviewed by Fiona, and got the job. I love it. It suits me exactly, as it's just afternoons. It's lovely meeting so many people from all over the world. Yes, almost all are Armstrongs, though you do get people who have just come in out of the rain or happen to be passing through." Seeing all these Armstrongs day after day, had she noticed any similarities? "Not really. Fiona tells me there is an Armstrong nose, but I have never noticed it. The thing which amuses all Armstrongs, and I can hear them laughing when they get to that particular board, is a quotation which says, 'Armstrongs can start a fight in a phone box.' They then turn to each other and say, 'Aye, that's very true.'" The storyboards tell the histories of the ancient Armstrong heroes and legends very well, and there's a good display of objects from the time, such as two-handed swords, cannonballs, pistols, uniforms, flags and banners. There's a little research library in one corner, with old books, documents, genealogical tables, and facilities for tracing your Armstrong ancestors. It is quite modest and folksy and amateur, but they do have a TV corner, where you can watch videos about the Armstrong history. Perhaps the most interesting and amusing, as some of it did make me laugh out loud, is one wall devoted to photos and biogs of well-known Armstrongs, such as, well, Louis Armstrong. I asked Fiona how on earth a black American jazzman could be said to be really a white Scottish Armstrong. "We're not saying that," she replies sweetly. "We are simply listing all the famous people with our name. His family must have been brought up on a slave plantation, where the owner may have been called Armstrong, which means he must have come at one stage from this area. All Armstrongs come originally from the borderlands." The majority of the famous modern-day Armstrongs do appear genuine enough, with their local roots directly traceable. They included quite a few Victorian worthies I had never heard of, such as Dr. John Armstrong, who helped found Great Ormond Street Hospital. I had heard of Lord William Armstrong, the great Northumbrian industrialist and arms manufacturer, whose house, Cragside, was the first in the world to be lit by hydroelectricity. He gave his name to Armstrong College, which today has become Newcastle University. Other worthies include Percy Armstrong, who helped invent stainless steel, and Edwin Howard Armstrong, another inventor, who is credited with creating FM radio. He was American, as were many of the famous modernish Armstrongs, and his name was commemorated on a set of US stamps. I discovered that Dame Nellie Melba, the great Australian opera singer, who inspired the peach Melba pudding, was really Helen Armstrong, but that was her name by marriage. She was born Helen Mitchell, of Scottish extraction. Dido, a popular singing person of our own times, is a real Armstrong, having been born Dido Florian Claude de Bouneviaye Armstrong, her mother being French and her father Irish. Lance Armstrong, the cyclist, is clearly a good role model for the traditional image of the tough, fierce, resolute Armstrongs of old, but his inclusion is a little bit of a liberty. It is his real name, but he got it from his stepfather, Terry Keith Armstrong, whom his mother married after his father left when Lance was aged 2. The most famous Armstrong of modern times is, of course, Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon. He is a real-born Armstrong, but no one has been able to trace his ancestry further back than Northern Ireland, which is, of course, where the Armstrongs were shipped when they were chucked out of the borders. He himself acknowledged he must be a border Armstrong when he came to southwest Scotland to receive the freedom of Langholm in 1972. During his visit, he said, he felt he was now at home. Unlike some of the other astronauts, Neil Armstrong has not proved keen on personal exposure and fame, becoming a bit of a recluse these last 40 years, so Langholm was lucky to get him on one of his rare public outings. An even more interesting outing was the US ceremony, not long after the famous First Step for Mankind, when he was awarded a medal and received it from President Nixon. Also present was the evangelist Billy Graham and ex-president Lyndon Johnson. Just look at those surnames, Armstrong, Nixon, Graham and Johnson. Names to gladden the heart of any old Reaver-obsessed romantic. All of them, presumably, must have had border blood somewhere down the line. The names live on today, and you can see them all over the English-speaking ex-colonial countries. In the current Clan magazine, there was a column giving the latest news from the Armstrongs in Barbados, and also about a visit by a Clan member to a cemetery in Georgia, USA, where 34 Armstrongs were imprisoned during the Civil War, and most of them died. Armstrong tends always to be spelt Armstrong, which makes it easy to spot them, but other border clan names can have many variations, such as Johnson, Johnston, Johnstone. There are said to be up to 70 different spellings of Elliot, depending on how many L's, T's or E's there are, but all come from the same original source. The day I visited the museum was the 20th of July, 2009, the 40th anniversary to the day of that historic moon landing, though I hadn't been aware of its significance till the week before, when I'd rung up, checked they would be open and arranged a visit. It was the reason Fiona Armstrong herself was there. Fiona is not only a genuine Armstrong, but for 10 years was chairman of the Clan Armstrong Trust, in a sense their version of a clan chief. She is still a director of the organisation and edits their twice-yearly clan magazine. She lives nearby and is always popping into the museum, helping out. But she is also one of the more distinguished and recognisable of the living Armstrongs in her own right. That evening, live from the little museum, to mark the anniversary of the moon landing, she was presenting a feature on the border ITN News about Neil Armstrong and his Langholm and Borders connections. Fiona was born a Cumbrian Armstrong, her father and grandparents coming from Maryport, but she spent her childhood in Nigeria, where her father was working for the British Council. They then returned to Preston, where she went to school, and then on to University College London to read German. She worked for local radio, then moved to Border TV in Carlisle. In 1987, she was invited to London to audition for a vacancy as a reporter-presenter at ITN. They were screen-testing 36 different women, as they wanted a woman to replace Pamela Armstrong, no relation, who was retiring. Fiona was the last to be interviewed, but she got the job. For the next 6 years, she became one of the best-known faces on TV, presenting ITV's News at 10, which got her into all the papers, and attracting the sort of personal publicity she'd never sought. "I did have a stalker once, a young man of about 18. He followed me all the way home, though I hadn't realised till I was on my doorstep. He tapped me on my shoulder as I was unlocking the door. I dropped my shopping, I was so alarmed. 'Now I know where you live,' he said. He turned out to be harmless, but years later when poor Jill Dando got murdered, it made me realise what a lucky escape I may have had." Apart from being a newscaster, she did foreign reporting, films about AIDS orphans in Africa, and covered the Lockerbie disaster and two royal tours. She then moved to GMTV, which was just setting up, and hated it. She had been the cool, serious, detached face on ITN, but now they wanted her to appeal to the tabloids, wanting her to stand up so the world could see her legs. She was told to wear short skirts, and to smile as if she had a coat hanger permanently in her mouth. "I do have many fine points, but my legs are not one of them. One paper kindly said I had astronaut's legs. Now there's the Armstrong connection.
After 6 months, she gave it up, left London to return to Carlisle and folksy old Border TV, where immediately she felt at home. Not just with the sort of work she had to do, but with life generally. She lived in the country and became a keen fisherwoman. She also felt it would give a better childhood to her daughter Natasha, especially after her first marriage collapsed and she became a single mother. In 2010, she was one of the, let's say, more experienced female presenters whom the BBC decided to use more often, having been criticised for being obsessed with the youth and looks of their current female presenters, but not, of course, with their male presenters. She joined the Clan Armstrong Trust 20 years ago, and as chairman, helped with a team of volunteers to establish the museum, working to get it accredited with the Scottish Museums Authority, securing 2-star status, whatever that means. She has made 2 dozen videos and films about the Armstrongs and Scottish clans in general, and was responsible for setting up the Reaver Trail. This is a drive round 8 historic border sites associated with the Armstrongs, some of which the Trust looks after. They all have plaques on them, and you can look up the history and position of each in a little leaflet. Trails are obviously a big thing in the borders, as I noticed the Telford Trail and a McDermid Trail in the tourist office. I am passionate about the Armstrongs, and I find the whole history of the Reavers absolutely fascinating. I do think they have too often been overlooked. In Scottish history books you hardly read much about them, just 3 or 4 pages, which is a disgrace when you think what a big part they played in Scottish and English history. Without the Armstrongs and the other border clans holding the line against the English, Scotland could well have been much smaller, maybe finishing just south of Glasgow. I do see the Armstrongs as a personal crusade. I do films and write about them in foreign publications, including the Scottish Banner, which is the biggest international Scottish newspaper. You must have heard of it. The Clan Armstrong Trust has about 400 paid-up members across the world. The current chairman is Michael Armstrong of Mungbyhurst, who happens to be a South African businessman. He has done years of painstaking research into the family, and comes over at least 2x a year and usually paints the museum's railings while he is here. They're all very proud of their clan motto. Invictus Maneo means I remain unvanquished. What about their traditional reputation for being quarrelsome? Fiona smiled. Well, I don't think it's worse than other small groups of amateur enthusiasts who sometimes get a bit carried away. We have had the odd storming out of meetings, but that's about all. They have their own tartan. In fact, they have 2. One is called the Ancient, which is greeny with a splash of purple for heather. The other is the Modern. There was at one time an Armstrong Lunar tartan to mark the moon landing and Neil Armstrong's visit to Langholm, which sold quite well for a while, but alas, the firm that made it has packed up. They are, of course, proud of having their very own museum. Their old rivals, the Elliots, have a small museum at the house of their chief, Margaret Elliot of Redhugh. It's just up the road at Newcastleton, with a collection of Elliot relics, but unlike the Armstrong Museum, it is open by appointment only. The matter of not having an hereditary clan chief, unlike most other Scottish clans, is a bit of a sore point. They have been chiefless since that Armstrong was hanged in 1611 and his son and heir did a runner. Meanwhile, Fiona herself has, in effect, joined another Scottish clan. In 2005, she got married to Sir Malcolm MacGregor of MacGregor, a tall, dashing, red-haired old Etonian and ex-Scots Guards officer who is a baronet and the 24th hereditary chief of Clan Gregor. In his real day-to-day work, he is a well-known landscape photographer who has produced several books, as has Fiona herself, notably on fishing and cooking. As Lady MacGregor, it would seem she has joined a rival gang, I mean clan, but she says no. Armstrongs are a border clan, MacGregors are a Highland clan, it's a different kettle of tartan. We are in fact quite similar. The MacGregors were also very wild, think of Rob Roy, and for about 150 years they were proscribed and no one was allowed to bear the name.
Apparently, some MacGregors had brutally murdered a load of Cahoons, and the widows took the bloodied shirts of their slain husbands to the king, who happened to be a pretty squeamish man. The image haunted him, and he said, "That's it, these MacGregors are banned from now on." They were the original children of the mist and were hunted down, rather like us in the end. Then a lot of them emigrated, just as we did.
If any Armstrong out there is willing to come back and is able to reveal himself as having the true blood of the last Armstrong chief, killed in 1611, then would he be welcomed with open arms?
Oh, yes, we would love a clan chief of our own. A clan chief would keep us all in line and sort out any differences, as we would all obey him.
Or her.
Of course, if she could prove the right bloodline, she could become our clan chief. We do from time to time put adverts in the Scottish papers, asking anyone to come forward who thinks they have the correct ancestry, and it can be agreed by the Lord Lion King of Arms in Edinburgh, but so far no one has been able to prove it.
There will be no money, or lands, or castles, but loads of honour and status, and perhaps now and again the odd perk. Her husband, Sir Malcolm MacGregor, does get one nice little gift each year, a complimentary case of whisky from the company who produce Clan MacGregor whisky. They use not just the clan name, but his personal coat of arms on the bottle top, so naturally they like to thank him in the appropriate way. I left the Little Armstrong Museum wanting to wrap it up and take it away, the building itself, as it was so dinky, so sweet and attractive. My stuff would look really good displayed in such nice homely surroundings. I wonder if the Duke of Buccleuch would be open to offers. I had a look at the foundations and decided it was a bit like a West Indian chattel house. The wooden houses plonked down on slabs which plantation slaves took with them when they moved. So I could cart it away. It would look great on Hampstead Heath, if I could withstand the campaign that would be instantly mounted against it. I also took away the notion that museums don't have to be devoted to physical objects. The sheep show illustrated that living animals can be an attraction, and the Armstrong Museum shows that a name is enough. I then headed north for another of Scotland's well-known preoccupations, though this time a more commercial subject and one with more topical overtones. It had been refreshing to come across a museum not really interested in pulling in large numbers, worrying about footfall, drawing attention to itself, or trying to convert outsiders. Most museums, after all, are hoping to interest the rest of the world in their particular passion. I'm like that myself, in that I am eager to show people my treasures, pass on my enthusiasm, even though I very quickly see eyes go glazed, attention wander, and I know visitors would actually prefer a drink to another flick through my albums of suffragette postcards. Perhaps if I had my own museum, I should try not to be too eager, just to be. Open up and wait. In its modest little way, the Armstrong Museum is providing a service, a point of reference for those who just happen to have a certain name, preaching to those who have already been converted by the accident of blood or marriage. Oh, and adoption. Clan Armstrong Trust Museum, Castle Home, Langholm, Dumfries and Galloway, DG 13 0ND. Telephone 01387 381 610. www.armstrongclan.org.uk. Chapter 13. The Money Museum, Edinburgh. You don't often come across abuse at museums, and certainly not at the sort of single-issue, unusual, odd museums that I was looking for. Amusement? I noticed a lot of that on my tour. People arrived at the Laurel and Hardy Museum already rather jolly, expecting to enjoy themselves. They were also smiling on arrival at the Lawnmower Museum. In this case, amused and intrigued by the daftness of it all. Could there really be a museum totally devoted to lawnmowers? At the Pencil Museum, there was a definite air of excitement, but that was because they had set out to be all action and activity, keen to involve the kiddies from the moment they arrived.
At the sheep show, I would say the first reaction was one of bemusement, perplexed, a bit worried about what they were going to experience. I could feel affection as people wandered round the cars of the stars, especially when they saw the Trotter three-wheeler. So, how awful to have a museum where, upon arrival, some people make